Food Chain. This is Sharon Chittone, and I'm a food tech junkie and innovation nerd who loves a good story. This podcast combines all of my favorite advices into a deep dive about the problems our food system faces and the visionary people working on solutions. Is space the final frontier and possibly a big help for our food system? Let's find out with Fawn Bagley, a space architect and industrial designer changing how we view space travel, food tech, and environmental sustainability on Earth. But Fawn achievements don't end up there. She's also an accomplished creative director, adjunct professor of industrial design, co-host, educator, and board advisor. So listen up. Are you ready? Here we go. Hi, Fawn. How are you?
I'm good. How about you, Sharon? It's good to meet you.
Good to meet you. This is going to be an exciting conversation. I am very curious about the work you're doing, and I will not spoil it for our listeners. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started?
Sure. So my name is Fawn Bagley. I'm one of the two partners at a company called Nonfiction. And what we do is that we take science fiction and then we make it real. And we do that for the benefit of humans, the planet, and as a stepping stone for future innovation. My background is in industrial design, which is the design of mass manufactured products, as well as aerospace architecture, which is the design of space habitats in microgravity or lunar or Martian surface. And so, it's quite the exotic background, but it gives me the space and the curiosity to touch every aspect of life, which I find very interesting.
That's very cool. So what kind of issues are you trying to solve at Nonfiction?
So we are basically trying to solve every issue. We really study, humanity and systems that are put in place, have been put in place for 50, 100 years. And try to redefine them, right? How do we sleep, for example? What's bad sleep? How it affects our focus, our relationships, and things like this. And we try to solve that problem. And we partner up with either companies that are developing cool technologies or universities that are trying to turn their research into products. And then we solve these problems. So I just gave you the example of sleep. We do that with education. We do that with food systems. We do that with the way we live in space, because the commercial space industry has been booming in the last decade or so. And we are still in many ways thinking about the future of space the same way we're thinking about the past of space. And as a designer, as someone who really thinks about human-centered design and the fact that each and every one of us will never attain the ranks of, professional astronauts of the past, we need to adapt design accordingly. So yeah, we pretty much work in every industry you can think of, but we specialize exclusively on physical experiences.
Okay.
So things that are made and are tangible. We don't really design apps or things that you see on screens, rather what the screen is.
Got it. So in your opinion, and based on your work, what is the intersection of space travel, food tech, and the environment?
So let's talk about space in the present. So the International Space Station is where astronauts typically live and work for a period of about 6 months at a time. And during the 6 months, they need to eat, right? And typically, they have three types of options for food. They have food that's ready to eat, prepackaged food, usually branded. They open the package, just eat it. They have freeze-dried food, which is, sometimes you see them in sci-fi movies where you rehydrate the food and then you eat it out of the bag. And then the third option they have is fresh resupply. So basically, every 6 months or so, a new rocket docks onto the ISS with a new crew or new equipment, and they have fresh food and aboard, and that's usually a pretty happy day for whoever's been there for 6 months. Why is this important? Because we are opening up the future of space to other destinations than low Earth orbit. Low Earth orbit is only 250 miles from the surface of the Earth, in the realm of space, that's nothing. And we are, with the Artemis mission, we are planning to go back to the moon and settle there. And then there's been, you know, talks about going to the surface of Mars eventually in the next couple of decades and settle there as well. So these long voyages or more risky voyages will require a different level of nutrition, because space by itself is extremely dangerous, right? There are different types of radiation that hits you. You live in microgravity for months at a time. You experience bone loss. Your blood is concentrated a little bit more on your upper body, more than you're used to, which is why astronauts have an inflated face and very skinny legs. And so all of that among, you know, on top of stress and isolation and the risk of death that you have to experience every day has a toll on your body. And food is one of these things that could help support all of that. So we as designers need to think about food as more than just sustenance, right? Because giving enough vitamins or enough supplements to astronauts has been good for so long, but now we really have to think about how it's going to build a culture, how it's going to bring them joy, how it's going to give them the agency to eat the food they want, however they want it.
Wow, that's super interesting. So what kind of technologies do you see in a spaceship?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pretty cool technologies that are being developed by various startups or NASA or different agencies. And I love that because it's really bringing up the level of variety, right? Here we have developed what's called a Space Culinary Lab, which is really thinking about how you prepare food more as a place like that feels like a kitchen than a galley. So a galley is more of a militaristic language applied to a place where you basically prepare food and then consume it. Whereas a kitchen is a place of curiosity, is a place of art and exploration and experimentation. And so when you go on a space mission, you usually have your food planned for you basically years in advance. And none of us live like that. All of us have cravings sometimes of certain flavors and certain cuisines, and these astronauts should feel the same way and should have access to these things. So the type of technology we have out there have to do with that variety. So some of it is about giving them access to fresh food. Mm-hmm. So some people are talking about aeroponics, which is a little bit like hydroponics, but using less water and basically sprays nutrients directly to the roots of plants. And there are some pretty promising companies that we're talking to that are expanding the type of food you can grow in aeroponics, specifically in microgravity. So for a long time, all we could grow was like microgreens and, you know, lettuce and kale, and things that were quite green and, you know, fun for a couple of meals, but then you can get really bored out of it. And so the idea of growing more nutritious food like potatoes or flavorful food like strawberries is being discussed right now. Another thing is really turning sad protein, I'm going to call them sad protein, but because usually they're just like rehydrated, freeze-dried food, into pet appetizing proteins. So part of the Space Culinary Lab that we built here has a laser that basically applies grill marks on tops of protein. And that protein can be a piece of chicken, can be tofu, can be whatever you like. And that simple, you know, action of putting grill marks turns a piece of meat into a centerpiece, into something that smells and tastes delicious. And that can really connect people in ways that they could not do with previous food that was available in space. And then every aspect of texture, right? Texture is so incredibly important. We're thinking about giving them access to coffee that is just more than, you know, just black coffee with a little milk and sugar in it, but perhaps we can turn it into something unctuous, creamy, and very satisfying to the mouthfeel. So yeah, we're thinking about things like that, and it's been pretty fun to experience and to taste ourselves the food that can bring them joy. Another aspect of our space that's quite important, and all of us experience that when we travel in an airplane, is that our taste buds are not functional to the effect of where we taste every flavor. So a lot of the food that we get in airplanes is actually enhanced either with salt, with sugar, with whatever, so we can even taste it. And so the same thing is happening in space. But the problem with that is that when you go on long-term space mission and you eat over-salted, over-sugared food, that can have a negative effect on your body. What? So there needs to be a balance between the two that we design properly.
That's super cool. So a couple of things. One, obviously, technologies that you can put in a spaceship, I guess like 3D printing. But also, I'd like to ask you about the possibility of using other planet surfaces for agriculture. What's your take on that?
Yes, 3D printed meats or other types of foods. Yeah, that's gonna become more and more real. There's also like lab-grown meats and types of proteins that are very promising. What's nice about that is that you'll be able to grow as you need instead of having to conserve, you know, protein that can go bad pretty quickly. So that's pretty important, especially for long-term travel. Just give me an idea, going to Mars is going to take a minimum of 6 months one way, and then you have to stay on site for about a year and a half and then 6 months back. So 2.5, 3 years total. That's, you know, if you prepackage everything, that'll be hard for sure. So growing things on the surface is going to be very interesting because there's plenty of space. You know, there are different types of architecture that allow for spaces to expand, whether it's telescopic architecture, inflatable architecture, or other types of combinations of craft. And so that allows us to create perhaps like vertical gardens in these environments that are insulated from the harsh environment of the surface of planets or the moon. And yeah, we just have to control everything, right? Because the sun schedule is different. The day is different, day and night. And then the radiation exposure is different as well. And so we need to make sure that we dial in the right wavelengths of lights, the right composition of nutrients, and yeah, everything on site. And some of it might be maintained by astronauts, and some of it might be maintained by robotics, right? So having sensors all over the place is going to be very helpful. Another big thing about growing things on the surface is gravity. So the moon has 1/6 of Earth's gravity. So what happens to plants when you grow them that way? And Mars has 1/3 of Earth's gravity. So, you know, in theory, some plants should be fine growing in microgravity, partial gravity, or Earth's gravity, but not all of them are going to react the same way. So that, yeah, exactly. One thing that's very interesting, I'm talking to some high school students in Peru, and in Peru, there are native potatoes that grow at high altitude, which is in essence an extreme environment, right? Very low level oxygen, cold environments, winds all over. And so we could equate that to something that's a little bit closer to the surface of the moon or Mars. So perhaps we can take indigenous varieties of like nutrient dense food like potatoes and grow them in these extreme environments.
That's very cool because it seems sometimes so far out into the future, but I guess it's not.
It's not. It's accelerating, right? Yesterday, they announced Artemis II crew. So it's going to be the first woman who orbits the moon. So that's happening soon. And then next year is going to be Artemis III, as the plan will be to land the first woman and person of color on the surface of the moon. So yeah, it's happening very quickly. So I'm excited for this. It's a good time to be in the space industry, which is a little bit of a contrast to when I started about 20 years ago. I studied space architecture and space design in France and in Houston, and nobody really cared. Nobody really cared about human-centered design, you know, for the future of commercial space. But now that's where a lot of investments, a lot of thinking and strategy is happening. And we need more of people like me who really care about these extreme environments. And the reason why I care about the extreme environments in space is twofold. One, space is one of the greatest motivators. You know, going where nobody has gone before is a wonderful motivation. And then two, it's become very clear that everything that we develop in space can be translated to applications on Earth. Because on Earth, we have food deserts. We have places where there are very limited amounts of resources in terms of quality of air, quality of water, quality of soil. And we are slowly becoming a planet full of humans, right? What is it? 10 billion people by 2050, something like that. And so instead of, you know, fixing problems, you know, here and there in ways that are not significant, we should completely redefine how we feed ourselves, how we create systems that are regenerative instead of just
linear,
like put together quickly linear and whatever we're doing right now, and really thinking about the long-term aspect of things, right? It took a long time for climate change to be to be put in place. And it's going to take a long time for us to step away from it. You know, no solution is going to like turn it off tomorrow. So we need to start today in order to think about 5-6 generations in the future and the planet we want to live in.
Absolutely. And I think that very few people really acknowledge the impact the food system has on climate. It's always something else when in reality it's responsible for 1/3 of all emissions. And if we want to survive on this planet, we need to not only educate consumers, but also regenerate the whole system, repairing the damage done in the last 40 to 50 years. So what kind of innovations do you have in the culinary lab today that you could apply on Earth? Everything?
Yeah, pretty much everything. It's just the idea of giving access to nutritious foods using very little resources, right? I mentioned earlier aeroponics, right? Why do we need massive amounts of land or soil or water in order to grow plants that are nutritious enough? You know, why can't we have these available in people's buildings, you know, apartments, reducing the transportation of the produce between the place it grows and the place it's being consumed, right? I learned yesterday that I think the average travel distance between those two points is an average of 1,500 miles. Yeah. And that's absurd.
Ridiculous.
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, I'm lucky here. I live in California where most things are grown 50 miles away, but most places in the world don't have that luxury, right? And we also need a very varied diet, right? That has a balance of protein, of, you know, greens and fruits and nutrients and things like that. So that, and also the idea that you can see things grow. I think there's a separation, a visual separation of where the food comes from and what it takes to grow it. Mm-hmm. And what happens when you go to a restaurant, for example, you have this beautifully plated meal. And because of that distance, people don't understand the repercussions of their behaviors. And that can be applied to food and anything else that we do in life, right? Like the way we consume electronics, the way we work, the way we clothe ourselves. If there was a shorter distance between the two, and if there was more transparency in the way things were described to you before you bought them, I would guarantee that most people would consume things very differently, oh, yeah. Right? But that's conscious blindness, I guess, that is driven by, you know, marketing campaigns and all that is making us more comfortable. And we need to find that balance between a world that brings us pleasure, which is important, but also behaviors that align with a responsible action towards the future. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So we mentioned some of the challenges we are facing, like lack of resources, quality of the soil, desertification. A study, for example, puts many of our vegetables today at 40% less nutrients than 50 years ago, which is a direct impact of intensive ag, climate change, lack of food or access, and as you mentioned, food deserts. What are, in your opinion, the greatest pain points that we still haven't gotten around to solve?
I think a lot of these issues can be solved, which we just talked about, like shortening that distance and increased transparency. And also bringing back the culture of cooking. I think living in the US, you know, I grew up in France where that's, I guess, is slightly different. But here it's so easy to order food, you know, from your phone, to have it delivered and to consume it without really thinking about what you're putting in your mouth, right? You might think about nutrition a little bit, or you might think about not eating too greasy junk food, but in essence, you're kind of separated from the ingredients itself, and really breaking down these ingredients and understanding what is nutritious versus what is here for pure pleasure is important. And another thing that I had to get used to when I moved to the US is the language around food. So I've always called chicken, chicken, or like different parts of the chicken thigh or chicken breast or whatever. But I've never heard chicken called protein before to US. And so people would talk about food as proteins and carbs and fats. And I'm like, well, you know, all these foods are actually multiple things at once. And really, language is very important to me because I think it tells a lot about how people respect what they're talking about. And even the idea of chicken, you know, like why would you sell boneless, you know, skinless chicken breast or whatever? It takes away the fact that it came from an animal, you know, that we sacrificed this animal for the pleasure of a dish. And I think that deconstruction of the food into non-animal and non, you know, origin respecting language is affecting the way we consume, is affecting the way we lose respect for what we put in our mouths. And I wish there was a way for us to reverse that.
Well, that's an interesting point, and I totally agree. Food is so many things to different people. It's cultural, but it's also about family and friends, like the saying, breaking bread. And yes, today, some people don't have the time to cook, but I also feel that access to good food is a problem. I mean, in the US, maybe a little bit differently than countries in Europe, where good food is more accessible in terms of price, people might not see that we have a problem. Like in the US, you have food deserts and you don't in places like Italy or France. But in reality, it's not just about the price, but the quality of growing and producing that is universally in need of change. And we need to take care of the land and need to use resources appropriately. And we need to respect food and our food system a lot more, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Couple of things. So a lot of your designs, I read that take inspiration from nature. Mm-hmm. How much does biomimicry inspire you, and what is it?
So it inspires us in many ways. When people think about biomimicry at first, they think about shapes, right? When you look at nature, if you really think about it, nothing about our bodies or nothing about a tree or nothing about anything on this planet has a straight line. 0% of it. And nothing has perfect radii. Nothing has buttons. Nothing has big screens or flashing LEDs or anything like that. So why do we design products that look like that? You know, think about the laptop you're using right now, the phone or anything else, even packaging. It's all artificial in many ways. And so we're trying to reintroduce these natural geometries, fractals or beautiful curves that really follow the lines of the body into the electronics that we design for ourselves, whether it's to hear music or to help people with tremor or to create different types of wearables to alleviate symptoms, healthcare symptoms. So I think biomimicry starts with that geometry. And then we also have to think about what nature does, right? Nature has the fantastic history, billions of years of experience in creating ecosystems that function with each other, right? We have the bacterial world working with the fungi world, working with the animal world, the plant world, the environment world, and And they kind of all live and die together, right? And I think that's one of the greatest inspiration we can have for the future of how we build things. Because right now, we build everything linearly. And basically, linear economy means that you take the resources from Earth and you transform them through manufacturing. You sell them to people who use them. These people throw it away and it ends up in the landfill. And a lot of people are talking about recycling and all that. And to be completely honest, it's just slowing down the process, but ending up in the same place. What we need to really do is to rethink the entire system so it's regenerative. Regeneration means that whatever you took from Mother Nature and transforming into a product can come back to Mother Nature without harming her, right? And obviously, this has an impact on the type of materials we're using, on the type of processes that we use to make these materials, on the properties of these materials. Because the reason why we're using plastic, and plastic is fantastic, is because it has incredible properties. It's lightweight, it's strong, it can be structurally built. You know, we wouldn't have the life we have today. We can have this conversation right now without plastic. Mm-hmm. But now it's time to move on from fossil fuel-based materials that come from finite resources that pollute in all the ways that we know, and then transform them into other types of materials, you know, that are being developed right now, right? Things that are based off of, you know, mycelium, for example. I learned recently that you can actually code mycelium to grow in the structure that you need. So think about architecture or even, you know, bricks that are built that way and have the properties that you need. But then once you're done using it, it just comes back to nature without harming her. So that's the kind of work that we are trying to think about in the long term. That's not going to happen tomorrow, right? Because we have to convince a lot of people. We have to convince product development firms to work that way. We have to convince material scientists to develop materials that are actually that we can afford and that have the properties that we need. We need to convince business people that this is the right way to do things, even though in the first few decades, probably going to cost a little bit more. There's just like this slew of people we need to convince before we can even make it a standard. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's the kind of thing we're trying to solve at this point in the long term.
Which is a great objective. How much does collaboration play in this vision?
It's essential. And I think that's one of the great things of the 21st century is that we are realizing that without collaboration, we can't do anything. No technology that exists today would exist without collaboration between technology, between science, between design, business, and art, right? It's really that magic collaboration. And again, using language. Mm-hmm. Collaboration always starts with language. If I come in a room and my ego is so inflated that I'm going to, you know, brush off everybody else's opinion, that conversation is not going to go anywhere. So finding common language, common understanding, common goals, and then start the conversation from there. And we're going to start small. We're going to start with solving little problems and changing our habits little by little. And then at one point, we're going to have a breakthrough where decisions that we're going to make as humanity is going to change, hopefully for the better. But that can only happen if we're being very honest with ourselves and step away from behaviors of greenwashing, of, you know, excitement around fake results and stop tapping ourselves on the shoulder every time something that sounds good is happening, because something that sounds good is actually most likely going to harm this planet, right? And so integrating methodologies like life cycle analysis in the development of a product is so incredibly important, because a lot of people are just not aware of things, right? I get to work with a lot of very experienced engineers who are brilliant in developing technologies and products, but because they've been doing things the same way for so long, it's very hard for them to step back and say, well, what if everything I've done so far was the wrong way? What is a new way, more responsible way of doing things that actually doesn't harm the Earth so much.
Yeah, I think that's part of evolution. But I hope we go towards a more regenerative model where collaboration takes over competition and starts solving.
Collaboration?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was about to say, collaboration can go many ways that are unexpected. Because a lot of times, for example, in the space industry, I gave you that example, no country, no agency in the world can go back to the moon and go to Mars by themselves. 0% of it. The collaboration is essential for that to even happen, right? And we also have to open the collaboration to unexpected people, because the space industry has relied on STEM for a long time. It's worked out very well for them, but then they're coming up to a wall, right? The science, the engineering, the technology, and the math behind everything that we're doing has allowed for humans to go up in space and come back alive. And that's fine for now. But then for them to thrive, we really have to start talking to people outside, right? We need to think about mental health, social studies, policy, you know, pleasure, neuroscience, and all these things that give a layer above sustenance, above survival. And that way of thinking is going to help us design for Earth as well. Because a lot of big systems are designed for sustenance and for bare minimum. But for each and every one of us to thrive, we need to create customized solutions that support each and every one of us whenever we need it, but also takes into account other stakeholders like this planet.
Totally agree. Jumping off on something different, I have a question. Can you explain to me what terraforming is?
So terraforming is the idea of, let's take planet Mars, which is a planet that, you know, has volcanic activity and barren, mostly rocks on the surface. The atmosphere is very thin, and the soil is very different from what we have on Earth, which is why it's mostly orange. And so the idea of terraforming Mars, for example, would be to change the nature of the atmosphere, of the resources that are on site, so they can support life the way Earth supports life. So oxygen, nitrogen-rich air, for example, soil that we can plant things in, access to liquid water pretty easily. So these are like super high-level terraforming aspects that we can apply. There are different ways we can do terraforming. I mean, I'm going to give you the most obnoxious one, I guess. It's just nuking the planet in a very specific way, and then waiting for thousands of years for that atmosphere to show up, basically. Obviously, terraforming is not something that happens overnight. And so right now, the way we're thinking about designing, you know, all of these habitats and all of these gardens on the surface of Mars is not terraforming. It would be done in completely enclosed and pressurized environments and basically sat on top of the surface of Mars without hopefully damaging it. And so, yeah, terraforming is a very interesting concept. I would love to find a way to terraform other places so we know how to do it. So perhaps one day we can re-terraform Earth. Because if you think about it, there are places that used to be very abundant, like different deserts, like the Arabian desert used to be flourishing. And because of the history of the Earth, it became a desert, completely barren of access to food and liquid water. And so if there's a healthier way to terraform, we could apply that to this Earth, to different places where humans really have a hard time living today, or humans or other types of animals and plants.
That's interesting. And obviously one of the resources that it's in most crisis right now is water. How do you fix that in the sense, where would the water come from?
Yeah, I mean, there's some technology being developed right now in desalination of ocean water, more or less effective. it's incredibly hard to do at scale. But yeah, I mean, I don't know much about the chemistry that's like in the mantle of this earth, but I know that there's some research being done and what's down there and what can be extracted. But yeah, and also when we go to other places in the universe, like asteroids or the moon, we'll always find access to water and then mix it with other things to create an environment that's livable. So perhaps it's something like that we can do on this planet. Kind of unrelated to terraforming, but very curious about the solar system and this planet Earth, is that helium, which is like the second element on the big table, is extremely abundant everywhere in the universe, everywhere in the solar system, tons of helium. But planet Earth doesn't have that much. And that's why we have a shortage right now. You know, all the scientists that need it in their research are freaking out because it's becoming expensive and hard to access. We're talking about terraforming as making Earth more like Earth, but perhaps as a way to make Earth a little bit more like space, where we take that helium and then bring it back to Earth to really serve our purposes.
Yeah, it's like we need to go back in time and do things better. So maybe in the future we can remake Earth.
Exactly. And that's one thing that, you know, indigenous cultures have understood. When you take, you give.
Yes.
When something is born, something else dies, right? It's that balance. But that balance can only exist if there's transparency. If we know where things come, how things, you know, are born and how things die, and the logic behind this. But the thing is that we've built cultures that see that as cruel. Right? Nature is cruel. It is. It just is, right? And we've protected ourselves from the reality of nature so much that we think that the creation of new things without the destruction of other things is sustainable, and it never will be.
That's an interesting point to me. Like, a lot of indigenous communities have this extreme respect of the earth and its resources, which is pretty much the opposite of, let's say, this modern humanity where we destroy more and more. So indeed, it's really about finding a balance between nature and, let's say, modern people.
Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Absolutely. And humans are also very ingenious, right? I mean, if they're in front of a problem, they'll find a solution. So instead of focusing on solutions that benefit the bottom line exclusively, maybe we can find a balance between the bottom line, the human stakeholders, and nature stakeholders, right? And that's when, you know, we need more people involved. We need to learn from the wisdom of the way indigenous people live for thousands of years. We need to listen to young people today who, more than ever in my lifetime, care about where things come from, where they're going, and how they consume. And then have these two ends kind of influence the way we redefine things. And change is going to be hard.
Yes.
Like humans, by nature, we hate change, right? Even if we're very curious and all that, it's just every time we have to learn something new or change a habit that we've had our entire life, it's going to be very hard. So that's why design has such an important place, because design is how you enable change and make it feel like it's better after than before, right? One example that I like to give is that every time you have use your phone, for example, you know, if I gave you the phone that you had 3 years ago that you loved, you'd see how backwards it is, right? Because you've gotten used to these new features so quickly. That's through good design. And I feel like every single system that we have in place today can have that transformation too. We just have to, you know, have the right people make the right decisions in order to design that transition to be pleasant. So I want us as humans 100 years in the future to look back and say, I can't believe we live like this. This is so backwards. The same way we talk about people who lived 100 years ago and think about how backwards it was. We need to evolve much faster in the right direction.
Completely agreed. if you could just snap your fingers, what is the one thing that you change today?
Ooh.
Yeah, tough one.
I think from a behavior standpoint, from a human standpoint, I would like for people to be more curious about where things come from, right? So that's kind of like the easy thing that I would like to change. The hard thing I would like to change is I would like to change how things are fabricated, because we haven't changed much about how we build circuit boards, for example, which are one of the biggest polluters out there, using rare metals and putting parts together that cannot be separated and just accumulating in landfills and polluting ecosystems. So really redefining how we create electronics and create the convenient world that we all love at the same time. I would like to redefine all of that in different terms.
So we are out of time, but can you tell us what's cooking for you and what's next? And where can we see your designs?
Yes. Well, you can see our design on our website at www.nonfiction.design. It's not .com, it's .design. We're pretty active on YouTube as well. So both my partner, Martis, and I were professors of industrial design, sustainability, and social impact. And so instead of just teaching a class of 12 students, we decided to produce our own video series where we make that information available to everyone, because information is where that transparency starts, where the dialogue begins, and where we can collaborate and build a better world together. So these two resources are pretty good. And then what's next? We have been in the process of really closing that loop between developing technologies that serve humans, the planet, and innovation on Earth, and then exporting all of these technology up to the extreme environment of space. And we're developing technologies in space that accelerate the way we can take care of this planet. So closing that loop has become kind of the center of what we do as a company.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure to learn more about this space.
Yes, it's pretty wonderful to be in both worlds and to see the synergy that happens between the two. But yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure meeting you and chatting with you about the beautiful future that we want to build. And so, there's hope, right?
Absolutely, especially what you said, and the younger generations, they got it right. I haven't seen such a fire, I guess, since the 70s. 70s till
this. We need more of that.
Yeah, we need a little fire.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you.
Want to dive deep into food innovation? Subscribe to the Food Tech Junkie series. Tune in and listen to the industry's champions whose mission is to reinvent our future by collaborating and disrupting the status quo as a way to rebalance our planet in our daily lives. For more great content, visit our website at www.edibleplanetventures.com and follow us on social media on the Edible Planet Ventures channels.